next case is 11-0756, Disciplinary Counsel versus Gallo. Mr. English.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Brent English. I represent Nicholas Gallo, who is the respondent in this case. The panel in this case determined that this was a matter of a mistaken identity with unintended consequences. I could not agree more. The facts in this case are unusual. My client is a very young lawyer who attended his first live pretrial in Lake County in June of 2009, and when there, was confronted with a sitting judge who was not involved in the case, Judge Lucci, who, for reasons that are very unclear, filed a motion to intervene in a divorce case in which my client was representing a party. The record shows that Judge Lucci was having a relationship with the opposing party's wife, and he filed a motion to intervene on the day of the pretrial conference in the case.
Counsel, I think when you say that it was a mistaken identity with unintended consequences, the identity was by your client. The mistaken identity was by your client, correct?
He was mistaken.
Yes. He thought the bailiff was the judge.
He did.
And he was on the phone and simultaneously is talking to his boss?
No. There are a series of facts that led him to this conclusion. One of them was that his boss, Joseph Stafford, at the time, told him, after he described this man who had been wandering about in the lobby of the Lake County Courthouse, that that's Judge Lucci. And Mr. Gallo's client, Mr. Reimers, specifically identified Judge Lucci as Judge Lucci. And then, following that, Mr. Gallo looked on the Lake County website to ascertain just for himself if, in fact, the same person was what appeared to him to be Judge Lucci, and concluded that the man looked to be the same person. He was undoubtedly mistaken. But he did not learn of this until approximately 6 months later, when, as the record shows, after I was engaged to represent him in this case, we learned that there were cameras throughout the Lake County Courthouse, and there were recordings that had been made on that day that revealed that the individual who Mr. Gallo identified.
What exactly did he say about Judge Lucci, your client, in the pleadings that are subject here?
Well, he said several things. The first thing he did is he filed an affidavit. Mr. Gallo filed an affidavit in which he said that his client was visibly distraught by the presence of Judge Lucci on that day, and he became more distraught after Judge Lucci was staring at Mr. Reimers for a considerable amount of time.
What was the intent of that affidavit?
That's quite unclear. I think the allegation, the way this came about was, as the record shows, is that Mr. Gallo was an associate in this firm. He was directed to prepare an affidavit as to what he believed to be the case. He did so on personal knowledge. He did not indicate that he himself had seen Judge Lucci. He did say that he observed Judge Lucci staring at Mr. Reimers, but he did not observe, and he did say that he observed Mr. Reimers being very upset about the fact that Judge Lucci was standing outside of his chambers, which has a sign, Judge Lucci, right above the chambers, approximately 70 feet away, looking right in their direction, and from his standpoint, apparently staring at Mr. Reimers. This was a kind of a very quick situation. So he prepared this affidavit at the direction of his firm that was involved in representing Mr. Reimers, and it was attached to the to a motion for, in opposition to Judge Lucci's motion to intervene, which was completely improper. Not attaching it wasn't improper, but the motion to intervene under Civil Rule 75.
Well, that's for the trial court. We're not concerned with that.
Okay, but in any event, the way this came up is it was in response to Judge Lucci's motion to intervene.
I'm a little confused about your client's then explanation here. At one point, didn't he say this was a collaborative effort to put together this affidavit?
No, he did not say it was a collaborative effort to put together the affidavit. He said that the memorandum to which the affidavit was attached was a collaborative, he called it a group effort, amongst three lawyers in his firm, including he was assigned to write a memorandum in opposition to Judge Lucci's motion. And there were other aspects of the motion that he had nothing to do with, including, for example, a claim that Judge Lucci should be sanctioned for.
Right, and but his name was on this or not?
Yes.
Gallo's name was on this memorandum.
My client assigned the memorandum, and but he was not the only person on the memorandum. Joseph Stafford was also listed.
So is your defense
counsel.
That here's a relatively new attorney being directed by a senior attorney, his employer, and he felt compelled to do what he was asked to do?
No, that's not my defense. I think that's highly relevant to what should happen in this case. But my defense in this case is that Mr. Gallo, based upon the facts that he knew at the time, based upon what he did, made a reasonable statement of fact that a reasonable lawyer under the circumstances would likewise make. And therefore, under the Gardner case, Mr. Gallo should not be sanctioned. This court has recognized that a lawyer can make a mistake of fact without being sanctioned with disciplinary sanctions.
Mr. English, you know, the reasonableness of the identity was there was nothing to prevent your client from going into the courtroom and actually seeing the judge in action, was there?
Not at all, nothing.
So, I mean, don't we look at what was the actions in verifying the statements in the affidavit?
Yes, I think you should, and that's why I tried to lay out what those facts were. The question, I think it needs to be looked at in the context in which it actually occurred. We have a lawyer who's never even been in the Lake County Courthouse, never appeared in front of Judge Lucci, didn't know who Judge Lucci was, had no reason to believe that Judge Lucci was going to be involved in this legal proceeding at all, had no idea that a sitting judge would file a motion to intervene in a divorce case for which he was just there to handle the first pretrial conference.
But yet signs an affidavit stating as fact that this was the individual that did these things. I mean,
yes,
that's the thing. The officer of the court who signs an affidavit and presents it in an official action as truth, and the court is relying upon the officer of the court to speak the truth. I mean, isn't that what we're concerned about here, the recklessness of not following through to make sure that what was being said was accurate?
Yes, yes, that's exactly what we're concerned with. And the panel ultimately decided that, or suggested, that Mr. Gallo could have gone back to the courthouse and observed Judge Lucci. Certainly he could have, there's no question about that. However, under all the circumstances known to him, his boss identifies Judge Lucci, his client identifies Judge Lucci, the man is standing outside of Judge Lucci's chambers and is walking around in the hallway. Nick reasonably believed under the circumstances that that was Judge Lucci, and he looked on the website to try to confirm it for himself, and it, in all respects, the facts that he had available to him suggested that it was Judge Lucci.
But according to the information that we have with this case, there was no resemblance between Judge Lucci and his bailiff.
Well, I know that's disciplinary counsel's argument, but there is quite a bit of resemblance, surprisingly. If you look there are photographs in the record. Mr. Ashman has the bailiff. Mr. Ashman has a mustache. He's kind of a stocky guy with a kind of a thick head. I don't mean any disrespect to Mr. Ashman. Judge Lucci's a little more diminutive. They are different heights, but of course you wouldn't perhaps see that if you were 70 feet away, which is what the evidence shows in this case where Mr. Gallo was. It's important to note that Mr. Gallo was not looking to pick a fight with Judge Lucci or to create a situation in this circumstance. He looked, he saw the man, he reached some conclusions based upon the information.
And he presumed that his client knew what Judge Lucci looked like?
Absolutely.
He didn't follow up with any question like, how do you know that's Judge Lucci?
Well, that's right. He didn't cross-examine Mr. Reimers.
That's not really a cross-examination. You're standing there and the guy says, you know, there's Judge Lucci.
There's Judge Lucci.
And he's staring at me. And you say, well, how do you know that's Judge Lucci? Well, apparently the man never saw Judge Lucci.
Well, we know that now. But we surely didn't know that then. And Mr. Reimers testified in this proceeding that that was Judge Lucci, that he believed. He had no reason to think it wasn't Judge Lucci. And after all,
he had no reason to think it was Judge Lucci.
Judge Lucci is having a relationship with Mr. Reimers' wife.
Wait a second. There's no reason for the client to see a man standing in the hallway outside of Judge Lucci's chambers and say, that's Judge Lucci.
There's no reason for him to lie about it. I agree. But there's every reason to think that your client, who is involved in this situation, would know who Judge Lucci was. In practical terms, if somebody tells you that's Judge Lucci, there's no doubt about it, and all the other factors that I've indicated, why wouldn't that be a reasonable justification for concluding that it was Judge Lucci?
Counsel,
and when it wasn't,
there is, whether it's reasonable or not, I think we've had a lot of discussion. One of the things that concerns me is, not only was the affidavit, let's just say uninformed, but it specifically alleged a violation of the rules of professional conduct. And rather than filing a grievance with the disciplinary process, attached it to a pending case so that it then became a public record. I mean, that seems to be a little troubling as well.
Well, Justice Kupp, I've thought about that carefully in this case. And I will just point out to you that Nick Gallo did not write the vast majority of that memorandum. He was directed to sign it, and he signed it. There's no doubt about that. He in fact, reasonably believed that what was in there was correct. Certainly in retrospect, one would think that if you believe that a judge has violated the Code of Judicial Conduct, that one is responsible for reporting that to disciplinary counsel. There is a whole set of facts that I haven't even spoken of that had happened in this case. Judge Lucci met with Joe Stafford, who is Mr. Gallo's employer at the time, in advance of maybe a year before, and had been asserting through his counsel, Judge Lucci's own personal private counsel, that Mr. Stafford had a conflict and therefore could not represent Mr. Reimers. This was Mr. Stafford testified that he thought he was being harassed by Judge Lucci in this regard. And so this was part of the context by which it is stated that Judge Lucci engaged in improper conduct. Also, he alleged in an affidavit, Judge Lucci, I know this is not about Judge Lucci, but Judge Lucci alleged in an affidavit that he had lent money to Mr. Reimers. One more fact that it would be reasonable for Mr. Gallo to think that he knows Mr. Reimers, when in fact it came to be that he had never met Mr. Reimers and had never lent him any money, but that's exactly what he said in his affidavit. So, under the circumstances, Judge Lucci sought to intervene where he had no right to intervene. He definitely injected himself in this divorce case when he had absolutely no right to do so at all. He stated false statements to the court about whether or not he had lent money to Mr. Reimers. And under these circumstances, it would be appropriate, perhaps not, maybe a more seasoned lawyer would have said it differently, but it would be appropriate to say that Judge Lucci is engaging in conduct that potentially is sanctionable.
The sanction in this case, Mr. English, as I understand it, is a public reprimand recommendation?
That's correct.
And what is your view of what happened here?
What should happen?
Yes.
I respectfully submit that Mr. Gallo should not be sanctioned at all.
Is your client still working for the Stafford Law Firm?
Absolutely not. He left there before Judge Lucci had even filed his reply to the memorandum. He left on his own after 6 months at that firm, and he is not working there at all.
And how long has he been a lawyer?
He had been a lawyer at that point for approximately 7 months.
Thank you.
I'll reserve whatever additional time I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Brown?
Good morning. May it please the court. Lori Brown on behalf of disciplinary counsel, relator in the case against Nicholas Gallo. We are here for one reason. We are here about the motion to strike. The affidavit that Mr. English has talked about and that he has been questioned about was attached as an exhibit. It is part of that motion to strike. It is the allegations against Judge Lucci in the motion to strike that reference and rely upon Nicholas Gallo's false affidavit that brings us to this court today. The allegations in both the affidavit, the allegations by Nicholas Gallo in both the affidavit and in the motion to strike, the panel and the board found violate Rule 8.2A and 8.4D. And the board, as this court knows, recommended that Mr. Gallo be publicly reprimanded.
What do you maintain, or disciplinary counsel maintains, he should have done reasonably? I've heard that he should have gone into the chamber, perhaps, and confronted Judge Lucci and see if that was really him. And do you think that's reasonable for a seven-month-old attorney to go into a chambers of somebody who is having an affair with his client's wife and challenge him? Do you think that's a reasonable action on his part? Or did I say, are you really Judge Lucci?
Actually, Your Honor, I don't think we even need to get to that question. The problem here is that the motion to strike even raised Judge Lucci's judicial status at all. The motion to intervene, when you take a look at it, it's stipulated Exhibit 2, does not reference Judge Lucci as Judge Lucci. He is simply Eugene Lucci, who believes he has a right, whether he's correct or not, to intervene in the Reimers divorce case because, and he sets forth reasons, he believes Joe Stafford has a conflict, he believes that he has a financial interest in the Reimers divorce. The motion to strike addresses the merits of the motion to intervene, but then it goes off, if you will, and talks about why Judge Lucci should not be allowed to intervene because he has harassed and threatened Jeffrey Reimers. Whether Gene Lucci was in the hallway is completely irrelevant. So
it does not seem irrelevant in the scheme of things. If Mr. Reiner is standing in the hallway and thinks that is Judge Lucci, who's coming out of his chambers and intending to intimidate him by standing there, why is that an unreasonable conclusion?
Why is it an unreasonable conclusion for Jeffrey Reimers to believe it was Gene Lucci in the hallway?
Yes, and why would not Jeffrey Reimers believe that that was an attempt to intimidate him if he, in his heart, believed that was Judge Lucci?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe the evidence is that Jeffrey Reimers, in his heart, believed that was Gene Lucci.
Did he say that was Judge Lucci?
Well, there's some question in the record as to whether he actually said those words, either the words, that's him, or that's Judge Lucci. They've been used interchangeably, if you will. The record is not clear as to what Jeffrey Reimers said to Nicholas Gallo when they were standing approximately 70 feet away.
Did Nicholas Gallo testify that that's what Reimer told him?
He did, Your Honor.
And so what is the countervailing testimony?
The countervailing testimony is entirely unclear. Mr. Reimer's testimony is essentially, I'm not saying it's not credible. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it's unclear. Jeffrey Reimers did not testify.
So if we believe that Gallo believed his client, believed that was the judge, is that unreasonable?
Well, to follow one of the examples Mr. English just gave you about the question of whether Judge Lucci loaned Jeffrey Reimers money. And Mr. English argued that it was reasonable for Mr. Gallo to conclude that Mr. Reimers knew Judge Lucci because he had loaned him money. Well, actually, Jeff Reimers claimed all along and continues to claim that there was no loan. So the logical conclusion would be, well, why was there no loan? He says here he loaned you money.
But that was after the fact. Anyway, so that's not anything he would have had knowledge of at the time he stood in that courthouse.
It was concurrent, though, Your Honor, because that's one of the allegations. One of Judge Lucci's reasons for intervening at the time was a claim that he had loaned Jeffrey Reimers money. A response to a client as a lawyer would have been, Mr. Reimers,
well,
you say no, but...
He also claimed that Reimers owed him child support because he was supporting child's...
He did. That's correct.
That's a pretty bold claim, isn't it?
Well, the merits of Judge Lucci's claim are not before this court. The question is
let me ask you this. What if Judge Lucci sent his bailiff, who he knew looked somewhat like him, I guess that's not disputed, out to surveil what was going on across the hall?
He did not, Your Honor. This was Wednesday morning, June 3rd, 2009.
So there was no character like this at all in the hallway?
I can answer your question.
Yeah.
Wednesday mornings in the Lake County Courthouse are pretrial days. Charles Ashman, Judge Lucci's bailiff, routinely checks the sign-in list, wanders out into the hallway, and as we now know, looks around to see whether lawyers who have signed in are there.
Perfectly understandable.
Charles Ashman is 60 pounds heavier, was at the time, and 6 inches taller, had a mustache. Gene Lucci has had the same beard for 27 years and is 5 feet 6 inches tall.
But you couldn't tell that in a photograph. He's looking at a photograph of Judge Lucci, so you can't tell height and weight in a photograph.
That's correct. You can see the beard, though.
And he has his own boss, when he describes the bailiff, say that's him.
Your Honor, our position is that even looking at a photograph, and I respect the fact that he did that. The photograph of Gene Lucci is in the record. There is no photograph of Charles Ashman in the record. That is not enough. If you are going to make allegations that a sitting judge harassed and threatened your client based on being in a hallway staring at your client, it is not reasonable. It is, in fact, reckless under the Gardner standard for you to have no personal knowledge that that was Gene Lucci and base it on hearsay, base it on supposition, base it on the word of a client who you also argue was very upset even being in the courtroom that day.
Counsel, Mr. Lucci, or Gene Lucci, portrayed himself not as a judge but as an interested party. And it was Mr. Gallo who introduced his position and title to the proceedings.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I don't think it really matters whether somebody was in the hallway looking at him or not looking at him, whether that was the real person that they're talking about. It's what he did with that ill-gained, knowledge, incorrect knowledge at this point. And the request or the allegation that this was sanctionable under the judicial
the code of code judicial of conduct, correct,
is what's the one of the troubles here.
That is the trouble, Your Honor. That is absolutely correct. They took the Stafford firm, and the question of whether Mr. Gallo was responsible for the content of that motion, as has been established, his name, attorney registration number, and signature appear on the document. He testified that it was his work product. There was testimony that it was a group project. There was a law clerk, another associate, Gregory Moore, worked on it. The claim to this court that Mr. Gallo, it was not his motion to strike, he, in his original response to the letter of inquiry, which is in evidence in this case, as well as his follow-up response, as well as his answer to the formal complaint, at no point does Mr. Gallo say, this is not my document. I did not write this. He now claims he did not write the words harassing and intimidating conduct. There is a question as to whether Mr. Moore wrote them or Mr. Gallo wrote them. Mr. Gallo signed this document. Mr. Gallo took this to court and filed the motion to strike. There is no exception to the this court's requirement that lawyers in Ohio comply with the rules of professional conduct for lawyers that have been admitted less than a year, less than 5 years. This is also about judgment, whether a lawyer has been admitted for 15 minutes or 15 years. This court holds Ohio lawyers to a high standard of judgment. It was judgment that violated the rules in making the decision to even talk about whether Judge Lucci was in the hallway or whether Judge Lucci was a judge in this response to the motion to strike. The question of whether the sanction of public reprimand is appropriate under the Gardner standard, I'd like to address that for a moment. And the panel gave Mr. Gallo the appropriate credit here for being a new lawyer. At the time, he had been admitted for just over a year. He was admitted, I believe the record will show, in May of 2008. So he had been a lawyer for over a year. Stafford & Stafford was not his first legal position. He had held one prior and left there to go to Stafford & Stafford. Mr. Gallo is not a danger to the citizens of the state of Ohio. If he has a law license, a public reprimand is appropriate in that regard. There is clear and convincing evidence. The motion to strike in and of itself, if you review the videos of the courthouse, you will see that there is no staring, there is no intimidation by Charles Ashman or anyone else. The record shows in this case that there is clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Gallo violated Rule 8.2A and Rule 8.4D, and for that he should be publicly reprimanded.
Is there any indication that he was told to put this motion together and include what he included in it?
Is there any
counsel said that he's not using the "my boss made me do it" defense here?
There isn't any question, Your Honor, that he was an associate at Stafford & Stafford. Now, I'm not privy, and I don't believe that there is evidence in the record as to what conversations precisely occurred. There is an interoffice memo, and there is testimony from Greg Moore. The interoffice memo is Exhibit 21. The testimony from Greg Moore is in the record about once the interoffice memo was drafted by Mr. Gallo, there was conversations within Stafford & Stafford about putting together the motion to strike, which was this firm's response to the motion to intervene. Precisely what words went into that motion to strike, as I said, the motion to strike is signed by Mr. Gallo. It also bears Joseph Stafford's name and attorney registration number. Both of those individuals—
He's the attorney of record. Stafford was the attorney of record, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Mr. Gallo was not?
He was. Mr. Gallo was—
On the original pleadings as well?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Stafford entered a notice of appearance in the Reimers divorce. Mr. Gallo was asked to go to the Reimers pretrial hearing. Mm-hmm. He was asked to go to the pretrial hearing the very day before that pretrial hearing. Testimony was that Mr. Stafford had a conflict that day and time, so Mr. Gallo went to the hearing in Mr. Stafford's place. When you review the interoffice memo, Exhibit 21, you will see that Mr. Gallo participated as Mr. Reimer's counsel in that pretrial. There was discussions with Judge Nicely about the motion to intervene, as well as about child support and other support issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. English, you have a little over a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. The videotapes are in the record, and they clearly show what Mr. Gallo was seeing.
Well, counsel, I'm not particularly interested in whether or not he was justified in figuring whether this was Judge Lucci or the man in the moon, for that matter. I asked you earlier whether there was a defense there that my boss made me do it type of a thing. You said no, but he was a 7-month lawyer.
Well, Your Honor, the evidence in the record is that Mr. Gallo was directed to write a memo, that it was a group effort, and that the specific offending paragraph that was at issue before the panel and the board was not written by Mr. Gallo at all, but instead was written by Gregory Moore. That's the evidence in the record.
Okay, so it's not his boss that... It's a collaborative effort between two associates.
No, it's a collaborative effort between a law clerk, an associate, Mr. Gallo, and Joseph Stafford. So there are four people that were involved in the production of this motion to strike that gives rise to this case. Your Honor, you said that you were concerned, Justice O'Connor, about the allegation in the motion about Judge Lucci violating the Code of Judicial Conduct. And that is not an issue that was ever considered by the panel or by the board. That was not a basis on which this finding was made. That there's an allegation in the motion to strike that Judge Lucci was using his position as a judge to intervene inappropriately in a domestic relations case. That's the statement that was made.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We will take the matter under advisement. You will receive our decision. Thank you very much. Marshall, would you adjourn court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.
Yes.
So?
Yeah, Appendix A.
Yeah, so is that the 15-year?
That's the 10-year. The 15-year is in our evidence at Exhibit A, tab B.
I'm asking about the one in the back of your brief.
10-year.
That's a 10-year, and so what is in blue is what? It says it identifies that. Is, are we to take it that's what a 10-year flood would look like?
Oh.
It says no change on the...
The map... Let me answer it this way, Justice Pfeiffer, and I apologize. The map should corroborate what the I believe it was the April 29th update to the Stantec report that 22 okay. acres
but
are...
What's in blue? That's what I'm asking. Is that what they're saying a 10-year flood
besides
would look
water?
Like? It says the impacts, it says blue is no change, but I don't know what that means.
Oh, I see. Blue would be, right, there would be no change.
Yeah,
right.
But does that mean that's where the water would be in a 10-year flood?
I think that would be where it would have been under the old spillway.
Under the old spillway?
Yes. Well,
why are you giving
what
me-
it might be, Justice Pfeiffer, again, I
oh,
haven't
it's in your brief. What is it?
Yes, it's showing, it's no, under a 10-year recurrence interval.
Yeah.
It's showing there's no increased flooding in that area due to the modified spillway.
So does the blue represent what the where the water would be in a 10-year flood? That's what I'm asking you.
It, with a 10-year recurrence interval, that would be the additional flooding shown in the legend.
And the yellow is what you're saying is that's what you're... Expert says would be caused by the.
That is correct. That's who we stand by.
And that's where the water would be in a 10-year flood.
Caused by the modification of the spillway, yes.
Have you seen those pictures that they gave us from the flood this year?
Yes, and we wanted to respond to them. Okay. We wanted to be able to analyze them and give you.
A whole lot more than this map shows it covering.
Well, this was before that. I mean, if the court wishes, we are still more than willing
okay.
to respond with expert, which they didn't. They presented no expert evidence. They showed more flooding. Okay, what's the causation? They haven't proved it. You can't just show. They could take a million pictures of water on their lands. It doesn't prove causation. Our guy did. And we've shown that due to the new spillway, some of the acreage is impacted, but not to the extent that the relators are claiming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ingram, you have used all of your time. You can start with a minute, sum up.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to go to the burden of proof. We believe on the basis of the evidence before this court, whether this court applies the standard of preponderance of the evidence or whether this court applies the standard of essentially beyond reasonable doubt, we have satisfied this standard. The expert's report that was submitted by ODNR in this case is fatally flawed in a number of circumstances. Number one, there are at least a dozen affidavits of landowners with photographs showing flooding on their property at various times, which ODNR's maps attached to its brief claim would never have flooded as a result of the spillway. So we have eyewitness affidavits and photographs showing flooding where ODNR's expert says there shouldn't be any flooding as a result of the new spillway. And why is that?
I understand Mr. Cole's argument. He's not disputing flooding. His position is you haven't developed evidence to show that the cause of the flooding is directly connected to the increase in the spillway. And he claims that he has an expert who has done that, but you don't have any causation evidence. Did you want to respond to that position?
Yes,
please?
Yes, I will. The causation evidence is a combination of both the affidavits and photographs showing that after 1997, and particularly within the last 6 of 9 years, flooding has been substantially increased both in duration and depth, as well as frequency.
And we get that from photographs?
photographs and statements of landowners who have been on this land for up to 50 to 75 years, saying, we know what the conditions were before 1997, we know what the conditions are after 1997, and we attest under oath that there is substantially more flooding, more duration, more depth, more damage caused after the spillway was modified. And I'd like
and
to point-
with no other variables that had occurred post 97.
Correct, there were no other variables.
Right, let
and
me,
they
let
haven't
me,
pointed to any.
All right, counsel, let me ask about a question, an answer that was given by opposing counsel. If we find that the statute of limitations is as you say it to be, then is the question for this court to determine the acreage and the who are the relators that are entitled to then have their cases remanded to the trial court for evaluation?
In the first instance, this court must decide whether the relators are entitled to the mandamus requiring ODNR to file eminent domain actions. The court is not required to go and into the record and determine how many acres of land has been flooded as per each relator. The Sixth District Court of Appeals, when it decided the Post case in 2006, simply ruled that the relators were entitled to a mandamus and ODNR was required to file eminent domain actions. It was in the trial court that it was determined the extent of that.
Were they required by the Court of Appeals order to file eminent domain against all of the relators, or is it then up to ODNR to decide which relator they will then include in this trial court action?
It's up to this court to determine which relators, and we believe all of them are entitled to that mandate.
How do we do that?
But it's up to this court. Because there is evidence before this court, the evidence that I've just mentioned before this court, affidavits and otherwise, that show that they have been, in fact, impacted more severely by flooding since 1997. Each one of these relators is entitled to that mandamus relief, as each of the relators was in the Sixth District Court of Appeals case. The Post case.
So you're saying that if we issue an order here, then our order has to contain language that each and every relator is entitled to be part of the action that ODNR is instructed to file with regards to eminent domain.
Correct.
And
we have done that.
Or do we have an obligation to go through and say, well, maybe 65 of them, we believe the evidence is supportive and 25 of them are not? Is that also our obligation and duty?
Well, Your Honor, we don't believe there is evidence to that effect. But if let's suppose hypothetically there was a relator who said in his deposition, I don't have any more flooding since 1997. I don't know why I'm in this lawsuit. Then obviously the court has
an obligation.
No.
I mean, that's an extreme example. But I'm talking about you've got an affidavit saying I've got more flooding. You've got an expert that says, yes, you may have more flooding, but it's not caused by that. Do we have to make that determination who to believe, what expert to believe, what individual to believe on each of the 95 cases? That's
what
I'm asking.
Yeah, and my answer to that is the expert that ODNR has submitted for this court's consideration has no credibility with respect to
it. That's what I'm asking. We have to make that determination under what you're considering. That we have to decide if we agree with you. They obviously think their expert's credible. You say it's not. Do we have to decide if they are or not? And then on each individual piece of property, are they credible or not?
If their expert is credible, then their expert is saying there's no causation here. And if their expert is credible, maybe the case is over. But the fact is, their expert ignored two salient facts. One salient fact is that he did not look at the lake level that ODNR maintains on this lake. And his flooding graphs and flooding models don't take into account.
So the answer to my question is we have to decide issues of credibility between two parties.
I think you're going to have to do that. That is the nature
of
mandamus.
That's my question. Not is or isn't, but do we have to decide that?
And on the basis of the record here, and because of the deficiencies in the expert's report ignoring salient factors, when he did his modeling, the experts' reports examined on their face tilt substantially in favor of the relators in this case, and
Thank
not
you.
ODNR.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ingram. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We will take this matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Thank you very much.
You need to excuse them.
You're excused.
And announce that you're doing. Yeah.
All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here for the presentation of attorneys. And the way that we do that this morning is to have the applicant stand when I call your name. The presenter will then come to the podium, give us a brief recitation as to why the applicant would be, of course, introduce yourself, and then give us a brief recitation as to why the applicant would be a fine addition to the bar in the state of Ohio. When that is concluded, we will then proceed with the oath. So our first presenter is Christy Pratt, and the applicant is Jeffrey O. Casaza.
May it please the court. My name is Christy Jessica Pratt, and I'm an attorney practicing in Cincinnati. I'm here to present Jeffrey Owen Casaza for admission to the Ohio Bar. I've known Jeff since 1999, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I am proud to inform the court that he is my husband. Jeff is not only a good man, but he's an exceptional attorney. Since I've known him, he's demonstrated a respect for the law, for the rules of court, and for the code of ethics. Throughout his 10-year career as an attorney in New Jersey, he showed a commitment to the profession that earned him the respect of both his colleagues and his clients. I know that he will prove to be a fine addition to the bar in the state of Ohio, and I am honored to present him to this distinguished court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jennifer M. Spaulding, presenting Lori Stobbs Foster.
If it please the court, I would like to present Lori Stobbs Foster. She would be an excellent addition to the bar of the state of Ohio. I have practiced law with Lori in-house at Abbott Laboratories for almost 11 years now. She's an excellent practitioner, and she is of the utmost ethical character and moral quality. She'd be a fine addition to the bar.
Thank you. Jack S. Klusnick, presenting Kirsten Torgerson Knight.
May it please the court. My name is Jack Klusnick, and I'm a partner at Weston Heard in Cleveland, Ohio. And I'm honored to present Kirsten Torgerson Knight for admission to the Ohio Bar. She's practiced in New York for 15 years. She grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, graduated from Cleveland Heights High School, graduated from Case Western Reserve University undergraduate and law school with honors. And she has practiced consistently and done very well in New York at both on Wall Street and in Midtown Manhattan. She's a mother of three children, and she's accomplished that while practicing law and pursuing a successful career. And to her credit, she has recognized that she would rather be back in Cleveland, Ohio, or in Ohio to raise her children in the Midwestern environment closer to her family who remains in Ohio. And so for those reasons, it is my honor to present Kirsten Torgerson Knight for admission to the Ohio Bar.
Thank you very much. James K. Wagner, on behalf of Jennifer Lynn Mildren.
May it please the court. My name is James Wagner. I practice in Mansfield to the north, and I'm here today to present Jennifer Lynn Mildren. I'm honored to present Jennifer. I've known her for about 23 years, which would be since she was 10. That's given me ample opportunity to observe her talents and her brightness. Jennifer graduated from Ohio State University and then from Capital Law School, and has been admitted in Illinois, where she practiced for 5 years. She's coming back to Ohio. She's got married. She recently had a child. She's lives in Columbus at this time. I know Jennifer to be very honest and very conscientious, and I know she will be a fine admission to the bar.
Thank you. Bruce W. McDonald, on behalf of Philip Eugene Miller.
Good afternoon, judges. Introduce Phil Miller. He's a brilliant guy, a chemical engineer, got a chemical engineering degree undergrad. He practices patent law, and he taught me everything I need to know about intellectual property law and patent law on the drive up here, so.
Courtney R. Owen, on behalf of Michael Lawrence Morgan.
May it please the court. My name is Courtney Warren. I practice in Akron, Ohio. I too am honored to present my husband, Michael Morgan, for admission. He's practiced for approximately 20 years in Georgia. But I think what makes him unique is that he's also served as a mentor for younger lawyers. For many years at Progressive Insurance headquarters up in Cuyahoga County, he taught the trial skills class and other classes for beginning lawyers. And I think that our practice needs more mentors. I think he'd be a great addition.
Thank you. Chester P. Peremski, on behalf of Aaron Davis Shedd.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Deputy General Counsel for Ohio Health Corporation here in Columbus, and I've been practicing law in Ohio for nearly 27 years. I'm privileged to come before you today to present Aaron Davis Shedd for admission to the Ohio Bar. Since 2003, Ms. Davis Shedd practiced law in Illinois as a healthcare attorney with McDermott, Will & Emery before coming to Columbus and Ohio Health in July of 2010. Shortly thereafter, she obtained her corporate status registration here in Ohio, and I've observed her practice. I must say we at Ohio Health are very fortunate to have found such a skilled and talented lawyer as Erin. She has demonstrated herself as a highly competent lawyer and has exhibited the utmost character, ethics, and professionalism in her law practice. Therefore, it is my pleasure and my honor to recommend Ms. Davis Shedd for admission to Ohio Bar as an active practitioner. Thank you.
Charles D. Smith, on behalf of George Frederick Smith.
May it please the court, my name is Charlie Smith. I practice law here in Columbus, Ohio, and have practiced for the last 27 years in the practice today with Charles D. Smith & Associates. And I do have the honor of introducing to you George Frederick Smith for admission to the bar. Fred is legal counsel for Instant Whip Foods Corporations. Their office is here in Columbus, and he's served in that position for the last 15 years. He graduated from the University of Texas School of Law, but has resided here in Central Ohio for the last 19 years. I have known Fred. I'm not related to Fred, but I've known Fred for 15 years. I know his family very well. I think he'll make an excellent addition to the bar in Ohio. Thank you.
Thank you. John C. Stump, on behalf of Crystal Sue Stump.
Good morning. My name is John Stump. I'm a partner with the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson, and it is my distinct pleasure today to introduce to you and move the admission of one of the best lawyers I know, who is my wife. Crystal has an extensive history in litigation of various types, including medical malpractice defense work, and also in commercial work. But her true passion is adoption, and we have two children adopted from Guatemala, and she has a practice that involves international adoption work. And that's really where her heart lies. I think she would make an excellent member of the bar, and I would ask that you grant her admission to the bar. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask that the applicants come forward and arrange yourself on. Oh, I always do this. I need a motion.
Move.
Okay. Everybody in favor? All right. I'm going to ask that the applicants come forward and arrange yourself on below the bottom step there, please. I'm going to administer the oath of admission to the Ohio Bar. I'll use the word swear. If you'd like to use the word affirm, you may do so. So I'm going to ask you to raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, state your name.
I, Erin Davis Shen.
Hereby swear.
Hereby swear.
That I will support the Constitution.
That I will support the Constitution.
And the laws of the United States.
And the laws of the United States.
And the Constitution.
And the Constitution.
And the laws of Ohio.
The laws of Ohio.
And I will abide by the Ohio rules of professional conduct.
And I will abide by the Ohio rules of professional conduct.
In my capacity as an attorney.
In my capacity as an attorney.
And officer of the court.
An officer of the court.
I will conduct myself.
I will conduct myself.
With dignity and civility.
With dignity and civility.
And show respect.
Show respect.
Towards judges.
Towards judges.
Court staff.
Court staff.
Clients.
Clients.
Fellow professionals.
Fellow professionals.
And all other persons.
And all other persons.
I will honestly.
I will honestly.
Faithfully.
Faithfully.
And competently.
Competently.
Discharge the duties.
Discharge the duties.
Of an attorney at law.
Of an attorney at law.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to administer the oath of office for the Ohio Bar to you. Welcome to the Bar of the State of Ohio. We are concluded. Marshal, will you adjourn court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.